From ABC News, this is Perspective, this week's stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, preparing for another Olympic Games with the Omicron variant looming over the Beijing bubble.
If Omicron's in a city that's 30-minute train ride away, there's a real possibility it's going to be in Beijing soon, if it isn't already.
The future of federal voting rights legislation in jeopardy as Democrats fail to change Senate rules to get it done.
It's not some hypothetical, it's not some far-off thing. It's happening now, and it looks like the Democratic response to what the Republicans have done in so many states is going to be non-existent.
And in a town known for not being very nice, everyone seems to have had something nice to say about comedian Bob Saget.
He was one of the good guys, generous of spirit, generous with his time, hilariously funny.
All ahead on Perspective. Across the country and around the world, the Omicron variant is now dictating how we act and what we do. Hospitals in many parts of the country are overwhelmed.
We definitely don't have enough people. I don't think anybody has enough people to do anything right now.
We are going to tell you about the latest surge and what's being done about it. That's coming up. But we're beginning thousands of miles away in China, where 20 million people in three different Chinese cities have been locked down to stop the spread of the virus. It's the strictest quarantine since the very early days of the pandemic, and the reason is because of the upcoming Olympic Games. They begin in just 3 weeks, the opening ceremony set for February 4th. ABC foreign correspondent Maggie Rooley is one of the many reporters who will be covering the Olympics for us. We talk this week about the outbreak and about the numerous preparations they're taking to keep Omicron from derailing the Games. In all honesty, Maggie, it seems to me like we just got done with the Olympics. I mean, we did just get done with the Olympics, and now we're going back to another pandemic Olympics. So what kind of preparations have you been taking, and have athletes been taking and fans been taking, getting ready for the Olympic Games in Beijing on February 4th?
Yeah, you know, Sherry, it does seem like we just came off the Summer Olympics. Obviously, they were delayed a year because of the pandemic, and now for the Winter Olympics. So it feels like we're just smack dab in the middle of this another epic ongoing pandemic. And I have to say, you know, all of the coworkers I've spoken to that are going from the media and all the athletes that we've spoken to, there's just this weight of COVID hanging over everything because people are paranoid. You know, no one wants to test positive because if you test positive, you can't go. Imagine, you know, for me, it would be a bummer, but imagine you're an athlete that's trained their entire lives for this moment, and then you have a positive test. As we know, Omicron is everywhere right now. You get a positive test, and you cannot go race. So people, you know, are rightfully so kind of freaking out about it.
And it also has to be even worse for the athletes. What happens with them?
Well, that's what's so crazy is if they test positive, whether you're an athlete, whether you're there with the media, whether you're a delegate, it's a 3-week hotel quarantine, at least 3 weeks. And it's all up to the Chinese government. Now, there are some rumblings, very recent rumblings, that might come under, you know, you could test out of that quarantine, because that's kind of a very old school way of thinking. You know, the rest of the world is focusing more on learning to live with this pandemic. We're talking about it going endemic even. China, though, is really doubling down on this zero COVID policy. And you see it even in the way that they're dealing with the Olympics. You know, their goal is to make sure that zero COVID cases break out of this really strict Olympic bubble. They are still determined to have zero COVID. It's a point of pride. And so the fact that they have this strict quarantine is part of that. So yeah, if you test positive, 3 weeks at least in a hotel.
Tell us what's going on with these three communities in China. They've got, it's 20 million people who cannot leave their homes because of the Olympic Games to prevent the spread of, the coronavirus.
I know, Sherry, just think of that, 20 million people literally not able to leave their homes, often not even for essentials. And the images, you think it's 2020 again, but it is not. It's 2022. And, you know, a lot of these are what they're calling Wuhan-style lockdowns, right? People literally sealed up in their homes, not allowed to leave. And a lot of them are major cities. You know, one of the first ones, Xi'an, that went under a city of 12 million, it is a few hundred miles away from Beijing, and they're battling Delta right now in that area. But it's a massive lockdown. It's been going on for 3 weeks. Authorities say it's now finally under control, but they're still not releasing people from lockdown yet. They want to make sure they've really stamped it out in that region. But what's so worrying and concerning for everyone right now in China is that they're starting to have some outbreaks pop up closer to Beijing. In particular, there's one in the city of Tianjin. It's a major port city, just a half-hour train ride away from Beijing. It's a kind of like a commuter town almost. You know, a lot of people go back and forth, and they've had Omicron cases detected there. So this is sort of freaking everyone out because, you know, if Omicron's in a city that's a 30-minute train ride away, there's a real possibility it's going to be in Beijing soon if it isn't already. So that's right on the Olympics doorstep. This is something that should be very concerning. If you're going for zero COVID, I mean, it's becoming almost impossible to get there.
Good luck. Stay safe and keep us posted about what's going on. It's going to be very interesting. And thanks for letting us know what's going on with the Olympics coming up on February 4th. Appreciate it, Maggie.
Yeah, always good to chat. Thanks, Sherry.
Kaiser Permanente in Southern California released a study this week confirming that the Omicron variant is less deadly than the Delta variant. But because it is so contagious and is spreading so much faster and infecting so many more people, it's been too much for many hospitals. There are 150,000 Americans in hospital beds now, 50,000 more than just 10 days ago. Let's take a look at just one state. ABC's Alex Stone is in California.
Here in L.A. County, Sherry, there is now a call to cancel events and get-togethers. A public health director saying Omicron is spreading so rapidly and the daily death numbers from COVID are up to where we haven't seen in many months. This is Dr. Barbara Ferrer.
The reality is that parties and events, especially those indoors, make it very easy for this virus to spread.
And frankly, like we've seen since the beginning of the pandemic, reactions to do more to prevent the spread with the high numbers here are mixed. Some are doing a lot, some are doing very little, believing there is not much of a threat. As I walk my kids to school every morning, more children are now an N95. Some parents don't put on anything at drop-off. Others are double-masked or wearing N95s. Up in Northern California in Sonoma County, the wine country, they're putting a voluntary shelter-at-home order back in place and a mandatory limit of 50 people at indoor events, 100 outdoors. This woman who lives in Sonoma County says, yeah, a lot of people aren't going to follow the rules.
People are too rebellious, I think.
But medical workers say too many, especially of the unvaccinated, don't grasp that there is still a danger with Omicron and hospitals are being overwhelmed, that even if a smaller percentage of people get severely sick from Omicron compared to Delta, with the exploding cases right now, that smaller percentage is a big number who will get sick and some who can die. It's not just a cold for everybody. 1,600 people a day are dying from COVID right now. Dr. Eric Snyder is at Cedars-Sinai Hospital here in L.A. They are holding patients in hallways, turning away ambulances, and ER wait times can be 11 hours to get in.
At the current moment, we are completely inundated with COVID patients. Our inpatient volumes are through the roof.
These are conditions that haven't been seen since the last surge. This one made worse by staffing shortages because so many healthcare workers are calling in sick, leading California now to say healthcare staff can work while positive for COVID if they have no symptoms when staffing is critical and they have to wear an N95 mask on the job. Nurses are fighting that new rule. Kevin Smothers is chief medical executive at Sutter Health in Northern California. He says the waits to get patients into hospitals are extreme right now.
Really been exacerbated over the last several weeks to months from that standpoint. We know it's been a problem in the past, but not to this extent.
Of course, the hope is that COVID numbers will begin to fall here soon and quickly. They've yet to do that. Hospitals are not alone with so many sick calls. Schools are fighting to stay open, calling on parents and retired teachers to fill in for teachers who are out sick with COVID. Reporting for Perspective, I'm Alex Stone, ABC News in LA County.
The White House has deployed 1,000 military medical personnel to six states where hospital staff have been overwhelmed. But critics say there's so much more that's needed. Dr. Raymond Lee Kaiser is with Columbus Regional Health in Indiana, not one of the states getting military help, but certainly in need of some assistance. He has been treating COVID patients since the start of the pandemic and tells ABC News in this audio diary that almost every person he sees now is unvaccinated.
We are definitely seeing a separation between those who are vaccinated and unvaccinated. Although we are now starting to see some of our vaccinated patients come back in the hospital, their course really is definitely a milder course. They typically only require a few days of medications, and most of the time they're able to go home without any oxygen therapy. Unfortunately, those who have not been vaccinated are typically running that very long course, very similar to Delta. And out of all of our patients who end up then getting transferred from the medical floor down to the critical care unit, we really are seeing that those are almost exclusively the unvaccinated patients. So Omicron is definitely a little bit different than Delta, and just really quite a surprise. I think our biggest thing was when we were going through Delta, it felt like that we were just getting over the worst of it, just getting over the surge, with hopes that better days were to come. And then, you know, really had Omicron right on the heels of it. And so we're seeing really this sort of second wave just superimposed right on top of Delta. There was barely time to breathe before Omicron rolled right on over top of us. And so, you know, our inpatient numbers are now hitting really where we were with Delta at its worst. So even though they say Omicron is probably more mild, I don't think we're necessarily seeing that with the unvaccinated. And unfortunately here in Indiana, we still have a lot of unvaccinated folks. So it really is just like a second surge right on top of the last one.
If you're one of the lucky ones who has not been infected with the coronavirus so far, that's good. But sit tight. Dr. Anthony Fauci said this week that the highly contagious Omicron variant will find just about everybody. But vaccinated people, he says, will still fare better. The second week of January could end up being one of the toughest of President Biden's presidency. Record high inflation numbers were released, the Supreme Court struck down his COVID vaccine mandate for large employers, and his signature voting rights bill, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, looks like it's dead after West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin and Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema said they would not vote to get rid of the 60-vote filibuster. President Biden went from sounding hopeful during a speech in Atlanta on Tuesday.
I will not yield. I will not flinch. I will defend the right to vote, our democracy against all enemies, foreign and, yes, domestic.
To defeated following a meeting with Democrats on Capitol Hill on Thursday.
I hope we can get this done. The honest to God answer is I don't know whether we can get this done.
So where does this leave the president, the party, and politics in general? Let's bring in ABC News political director Rick Klein.
This was something that the president had been talking about since day one and got in there. And the vice president, Kamala Harris, was very adamant about it. We're going to get this done. We're going to get this done. And the president, you know, telling Mary Bruce this week that I hope to God we can get it done, but I just don't know at this point. I mean, that doesn't sound very positive or promising.
No, and you know, Biden's an optimistic guy. He also knows the Senate pretty well, but this was a pretty devastating blow. And what part of what makes it curious, Sherry, is that everyone has known the dynamics have been the same all year. That's not a surprise to anyone. Still, President Biden decided to put it on the line, decided to bring this to a head, and ultimately it ended in an embarrassment, which is Chuck Schumer having to pull from the floor any effort to change the rules. They know what the result is going to be. And all of that determination and all of that we're going to fight fizzled out. And look, you can't say Democrats didn't see it coming. The fact is, voting starts in about a month, believe it or not, in the midterm elections. The Texas primary is March 1st, and early voting will be in the middle of February. So these rules are already having an impact. It's not some hypothetical. It's not some far-off thing. It's happening now, and it looks like the federal legislation, the Democratic response to what the Republicans have done in so many states, is going to be non-existent.
Can you give some examples of what the biggest laws and changes are on voting rights when it comes to individual states? Do you have that information handy at all, Rick?
Sure. Yeah, there's 19 states that have made changes, and they've done it in a whole range of ways. Some states have just basically gone back to basically what the pre-COVID rules were like, which means fewer days of early voting, fewer drop boxes and absentee information. Some states, though, like Georgia, Texas, have made it significantly harder to apply for a ballot. In some cases, as in Georgia, quite infamously, they're making it a crime to bring individuals food or water when they're standing on long lines. Texas is limiting rather dramatically the number of drop boxes that are available in each county. Obviously, in Texas, you've got very urban counties like Harris County around Houston, where there's the need for lots of drop boxes. You've got very rural counties that may only have 1,000 people, where it's really not as much of an issue.
What would the bill that the president wants to get passed actually do?
These are quite sweeping bills. Parts of them would restore some powers to the Justice Department to be able to challenge states that pass laws that are more restrictive, including new redistricting laws that might hurt minorities. Another thing it would do is create nationwide standards and minimum guarantees for the availability of early voting, of absentee voting, and set federal standards around a lot of elections. And there's precedent for that. We've seen it in Voting Rights Acts going back to the 1960s. But since then, and really throughout our 200 plus years as being a democracy, states have had wide latitude in how they conduct elections for lots of good reasons, by the way. I mean, states look different. They have different traditions. People get used to a particular way that they vote. And there's a reason that the Constitution carves that out. But this would, though, meet some of these new restrictions and wipe them away or soften their blow, make it easier for people to vote overall. Also, though, in the views of some Republicans, make it easier to have fraud or abuse, even though there's been no documented fraud that's had any impact on American elections in decades.
Rick, what's the date of the midterms?
It is Tuesday, November 8th, a little bit later than normal this year because the Constitution mandates that it's the first Tuesday after the first Monday. So a little bit of extra breathing room for all those candidates. And if you're in one of those battleground states, that's an extra week or so of seeing lots of campaign ads.
Okay. ABC News political director Rick Klein. Thanks again.
Thanks, Sherry. Thank you.
As Rick stated, 19 states have enacted new voting laws following the 2020 election, the most restrictive coming from Republican states like Georgia and Texas. Some of the laws might be inspired by the big lie of the election being stolen and pressure from Republican voters to do something about it. Kaylee Rogers is a tech and politics expert with our partners at 538. She did a deep dive into the pressure that Republican state lawmakers are facing in a piece called The Big Lie's Long Shadow. She and Brad Milkey talked about it during our daily news podcast this week. Start here.
Kaylee, you spoke to several legislators as part of the story. What did they tell you?
So in the piece, I opened by focusing on Montana, and this was not to pick on Montana in any way, but when I was looking at kind of our catalog that we put together of all the bills that had been introduced, changing election law, Montana really stood out to me because we're all familiar with kind of what's been happening in the swing states, seeing, you know, the pushback from Trump against the results in certain states. I really wasn't expecting to see six new election laws passed in Montana. You know, this is not a swing state. This is a solid Republican state. There was no, you know, talk that there was any kind of fraud happening in Montana. And yet even there, we're seeing changes being made to the way the elections are run in response to the big lie.
You name a metric from the 2020 election that you would use to conclude that there was widespread voting fraud. And that metric has shown the opposite, right? Like, we're talking about audits, audits of the audits, hand recounts, video surveillance. Like, Democrat and Republican officials have all agreed on this. Judges have ruled on it. It all points to that there was a fair election. So where are the activists getting the information that they're using to make to create these pressure campaigns?
Right. I mean, so there's a whole network of right-wing kind of influencers who continue to push this big lie, who have kind of created their own metrics. They've done their own kind of quote-unquote research that I look into the piece that, you know, claims to have evidence showing fraudulent ballots being cast. And you really kind of end up with this Gishgalop effect where there's so much quote-unquote evidence that regular voters are seeing shared online that no matter how many sort of debunks you do or fact checks you do online, there's always another mountain of clues for them to sift through and things for them to believe. So it at this point, trying to counter it is really difficult. And another individual who's been kind of big in this world is a guy named Seth Keschel. He's a former Army captain. And he put out a report showing that there was, you know, the number of votes that were cast compared to what was expected. And that analysis was just based on his own projection of what he expected the vote turnout to be. And I mean, he has.
Wait, he's saying, wow, votes were way higher than expected, but the expected number was just his own intuition.
Well, I mean, he did base it on, you know, different data points that he put into, you know, a metric that he used to calculate for himself, but he hasn't shared that. And so, there's all these questions around what exactly this is supposed to prove. And there's many people putting forward reports and things like this, and they're being taken seriously. They're talking to state legislators. And for politicians, what you're left with is, how do we respond to this? Because I have, you know, constituents calling me saying, fraud happened. What do we do? How do we protect our vote going forward? And having to make a decision about, you know, are there things I can change about election laws in our state that might, you know, appease some of these people without making it so disruptively hard to vote that it's actually voter suppression.
That was 538's Kaylee Rogers with Brad Milkey on our daily podcast, Start Here. You can read The Big Lies, Long Shadow on 538.com. Coming up, we'll tell you how supply chain disruptions and inflation are hitting everything out there, including the pet food market. On Perspective after this.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
From ABC News, this is Perspective, a closer look at the week's stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, why did so many people love Bob Saget? The comedian was, as they say, one of a kind. But first, Americans are getting squeezed by the cost of everything. According to the Labor Department's Consumer Price Index report released this week, inflation jumped 7% over the past 12 months, the largest spike since the summer of 1982. Housing, used cars, and groceries were the biggest contributors to inflation. But you know what else you're paying more for? Pet food. It not only costs you more money, but in some places you can't find the kind of food your dog or cat likes. ABC News producer Megan Stone has been talking to some of the folks who make pet food and to veterinarians about what you can do to help lower the costs.
Like many industries in the COVID-19 era, the world of pet food is being tested. Dan Laval is the manager of Pet World in Natick, Massachusetts, and he says he's having a hard time keeping his shelves stocked.
We're on the phones daily with our suppliers, and they're trying to get the inventory as best as they can.
But what's causing the shelves in Pet World and other stores to go empty? Dana Brooks is the president and CEO of the Washington, D.C. Pet Food Institute, whose members make nearly all of the country's pet foods and treats. And she says it boils down to two things.
We're in unprecedented demand. We are also in an unprecedented supply chain challenge.
Brooks has heard from pet food makers, large, small, and everything in between.
We're impacted the same as human food supply. People don't realize how close we are related to human food. So some of their same challenges are our challenges. Specifically, right now, our challenge sourcing fats and oils, you know, animal protein products. That was compounded with a disruption in the meat industry last year and year before with the supply chain challenges.
American pet food makers source most, but not all their ingredients domestically. And Brooks says that means any and all international COVID-19 related shipping issues also become their issue.
There are some minerals or some vitamins that we don't produce here in the United States or not even mined in the United States. Those type of ingredients are dependent on what's going on in that other country's ports. And at some point, you know, we bear that and the manufacturing industry, as long as possible, we certainly are reluctant to increase our prices. I can assure you the first person that I hear from when the price changes is my mother.
But when will the market stabilize and bring relief to pet owners? Dr. Pooja Manjanath, who co-owns Ansonia Westfield Veterinary Hospital in Ansonia, Connecticut, predicts it'll be years before we see the light at the end of the tunnel.
I'm hoping that within the next 2 years, unfortunately, with everything that's going on right now, I feel like things are going to get a little worse before we start to have that spiral up.
Obviously, that's not the answer pet owners want to hear. Another option is making your pet's food last longer. She suggests mixing in inexpensive but safer pet human food like carrots, broccoli, and green beans that come in those big frozen bags at your local grocery store.
Steam those, smush them up, mix it in with the canned food, and your puppy may think, oh my god, I'm getting a whole can of food, but it's actually half a can mixed with a whole bunch of vegetables.
Carbs like rice and quinoa are also safe to eat, she says. But when it comes to protein, Dr. Pooja says be careful of what kind of meat you give your pet. Fattier options like lamb and beef could cause an upset stomach, so she says stick to the lean meats like turkey and chicken. An unnecessary trip to the animal hospital only adds to the extreme stress veterinarians and their staff are already experiencing. Dr. Pooja says her team is working overtime because of staffing shortages caused by COVID-19 exposure and infection. But despite these challenges presented by the pandemic, Dr. Pooja says veterinarians are still going to go above and beyond to make sure your pet is healthy. Reporting for Perspective, I'm Megan Stone.
2022 is shaping up to be the year the electric truck market will explode in popularity. Traditional brands like Ford and Chevy, as well as startups like Rivian, are upping production targets, announcing new models, and finally starting to deliver trucks. ABC News tech producer Mike Dubusky has more on what's new in the electric truck industry.
You would be forgiven for thinking that the electric car craze is actually an electric truck craze.
No limits, no emissions, and no equals.
This is America's truck electrified.
There's all the splashy commercials, the prestigious awards.
The Motor Trend 2022 Truck of the Year is
the Car of the Year Award goes to
the Rivian R1T.
The Rivian R1T.
And there they are getting in the car. Looks like they're about to drive off over to the launch pad.
The support vehicles for Jeff Bezos' trip to space last year.
Start. 2-1.
Those were Rivians, a new EV truck startup. And who could forget this moment just a couple years ago?
Los Angeles, November 2019. I now present to you my creator.
When Tesla CEO Elon Musk,
I love you guys too. I love you guys too.
Unveiled the Blade Runner-inspired Cybertruck.
Oh, man.
And then promptly smashed the supposedly unsmashable windows.
Room for improvement.
Then just last week, there was this announcement from General Motors CEO Mary Barra.
This is a purpose-built Chevrolet Silverado EV.
Silverado EV is actually a natural fit for electric vehicles.
That's Scott Hoskison, lead program manager for electric pickup trucks at GM.
In the Silverado EV, we're offering up to 664 horsepower and 780 pound-feet of torque.
GM says it's investing $35 billion into electric vehicles by 2025, with plans to sell nothing but EVs by 2035. A big part of that is going to be the company's new specially designed electric platform that it's calling Ultium.
A ground-up EV means that Chevrolet, General Motors could put the batteries as structural elements in the floor.
That's Chad Kirshner, editor-in-chief of EV Pulse. In the past, automakers would essentially cram some batteries into one of their existing cars, slap an EV badge on it, and call it a day. Electric trucks come with a lot of potential practicality, which brings us to the other reason so many automakers are committing to these things.
This is a trend we are seeing all across the country.
Americans love pickup trucks.
We're seeing a lot of spikes in demand for things like pickup trucks, large SUVs.
Ford sold over 700,000 F-Series trucks in 2021, making it the best-selling vehicle in the country for the 44th straight year. Ram and Chevy were right behind it, both selling over 500,000 pickups last year. In fact, a traditional car doesn't even show up in the top five of this list. And Kirshner says there's a good reason for that.
Truck makers long ago learned that they can make a lot more money by offering a family car experience with a bed, which is what a modern pickup truck ultimately is. Why have two cars in your driveway when you could have one that does everything?
Rivian was the first of this new wave of EV trucks to actually start making deliveries earlier this winter, but others are close behind. So while you may not have seen an electric truck on the road yet, you probably will soon. And there's a good reason for automakers to be hitting the gas, sorry, accelerator, when it comes to these trucks. Back in 2020, California Governor Gavin Newsom signed an executive order requiring all new cars sold in that state to be zero emission by 2035. But it's not exactly a smooth road ahead. A global semiconductor shortage has delayed production across the auto industry, especially at General Motors. The Indiana factory that makes the gasoline Silverado halted production multiple times last year on account of the chip shortage, and sales ended up dropping 13%. The electric version that debuted last week isn't set to hit dealers until 2023. That's more than a year after Ford's targeted date. Plus, reliable charging is still pretty hard to come by. The notable exception to that is Tesla, which operates thousands of supercharger stations around the world that only work with Tesla vehicles. But that company has a different problem. The Cybertruck, which was originally planned to go into production in late 2021, well, last year that production date, along with some other key information like the truck's price, quietly vanished off Tesla's website. Reporting for Perspective, I'm Mike Dubusky, ABC News.
You know what electric trucks don't have? Catalytic converter. And catalytic converters are something that is in high demand these days. A sweeping crime wave has been hitting the country, targeting cars, but thieves aren't going after the entire vehicle. They are instead taking that catalytic converter, which is part of the exhaust system. Thefts have increased over the past few years as prices for the precious metals that make up that car part have increased, and criminals are getting more brazen. Here's ABC Transportation correspondent Gio Benitez.
Police rushing to a San Antonio neighborhood this week after a 33-year-old man was shot when he confronted someone who he says was trying to steal the catalytic converter under his car. And in late December in Washington State, another scary encounter, a couple catching a group of thieves under their van, the husband approaching the group.
He ran toward them and yelling for them to stop, and they weren't stopping.
Beth, speaking with our ABC affiliate in Seattle, Como, says the thieves did not seem concerned that they had just been caught.
And one of them pulled a gun and shot it in the air. They finished up. They kept going. They finished up and then left a couple minutes later.
Folks are able to steal these converters, and because of the online buyers, it's a lucrative business, and we're going to do all we can to try and interrupt that.
In August, Houston police finding more than 300 catalytic converters and arresting two men. In suburban Maryland, this mechanic tells us thieves target Toyota Priuses because their parts are worth more.
They get in and out very quickly, 5, 10, 15 minutes, I would think, tops.
On average, police say thieves can make up to $300 per converter. The precious metals in the catalytic converters soaring in value, now worth more than gold. State Farm telling ABC News it's paid out $43 million in claims for catalytic converter theft in just a year. One way to protect your car, adding a steel plate cover over your catalytic converter.
ABC Transportation correspondent Gio Benitez. Of course, you could always just get one of those electric trucks, too. The medical examiner in Orlando, Florida, says it could take as long as 3 months to find out the official cause of death for comedian Bob Saget. You know by now that he was found in his hotel room on his bed with no signs of trauma or foul play. You also know, if you've been listening to any of the numerous friends who've come forward this past week with stories about who he was, that Bob Saget was loved by many. In fact, it's hard to find anyone who will say anything bad about him. And in Hollywood, that is extremely rare. Bob Saget seems to have been one of a kind. But why? Here's ABC Entertainment correspondent Jason Nathanson.
America first really got to know Bob Saget as Danny Tanner, the widowed dad of three daughters on the ABC sitcom Full House.
Your mom was always so good at this stuff. I'd come home from work and everything was always perfect.
You couldn't help but root for him and his family. He was the dad you always wanted. Patient, kind, goofy. The show premiered in 1987, and by 1989, it was the anchor of ABC's TGIF Friday night lineup. And then came America's Funniest Home Videos.
It's a bird. It's a dog. It's Bird Dog.
Bob Saget hosted videos viewers would send in of kids hitting parents in sensitive areas with wiffle ball bats, birthday cake mishaps, whatever funny thing Americans captured on their newly purchased camcorders, with a voiceover from Saget that was funny, but safe and clean. the king of the dad joke.
Now, how can you tell when a baby's full? When they start overheating.
She's interested in everything.
And just like that, Bob Saget was America's dad.
He was one of the good guys, generous of spirit, generous with his time, hilariously funny, and warm.
Melissa Rivers, the daughter of comedian Joan Rivers, spent a lot of time with Saget. Her mom was a big fan.
She thought Bob was hilarious and very much respected how multifaceted his career was, which was very similar to hers. I mean, he acted, he hosted, he produced, he directed, but just like my mom, the happiest place was on tour and on the stage.
Comedians loved him, including Gilbert Gottfried, who tells ABC News when he got the call that Saget had died suddenly on Sunday at the age of 65.
I remember I was like, thought it was a sick joke, and I was waiting for the punchline. And then it didn't come. And it's like, I still feel right now like I'm waiting for the punchline to happen, that it was all a big joke. It was all a hoax.
The two were friends for years, and yes, Saget was America's dad until you went to see him on stage. Then you realized that America's dad was dirty. Really, really raunchy.
There was a movie, The Aristocrats, and they were surprised that he could talk dirty or sick or anything.
In Gottfried's movie, The Aristocrats, comedians all tell a different but similar version of the same joke, which is thought to be the dirtiest joke of all time. But Saget's version, it's 7 minutes of pure filth that would make the devil blush.
Then they all start making out. You know, they're making, all kidding aside.
And people who knew him weren't at all surprised by this. And I remember when we would talk, if it got at all sentimental or sensitive or sincere, it would quickly turn to something in totally poor taste.
Another close comedian friend of Bob Saget was Mike Young. The two were touring partners. Young devastated by Saget's death.
Pretty terrible, actually. It's shocking. It's, you know, nobody's holding up great.
After the first few years of Full House, Saget struggled a little with his image. People saw him as America's dad, but there's a lot of pressure that comes with that. And he didn't feel like that person. He didn't have all the answers, and he didn't like that he was put into a box. But as the years went on, he accepted it, and then eventually embraced it, in part because he knew he'd touched people's lives.
You know, we were in Omaha 3 weeks ago, and the chef of the hotel came up to him and said, me and my daughter bonded over your show, and that, for, you know, I cannot thank you enough.
Whatever happened to predictability?
Stories like that from strangers filled Saget with love. He overflowed with it. And Melissa Rivers says it oozed out of him and into those around him.
We are all in such a tough business that is generally not kind and can chew people up and spit them out. And when you come across someone who is just positive and warm and makes you feel good about yourself, it's pretty rare. It's pretty rare in life.
Jason Nathanson, ABC News, Hollywood.
One thing Bob Saget was passionate about was research into scleroderma. It's an autoimmune disease that has no cure. It causes inflammation in the skin and other areas of the body, and in severe cases, it can kill. It is what killed Bob's sister in 1994. He served on the Scleroderma Research Foundation board and through comedy events raised over $25 million over the years toward funding research. In memory of Bob Saget, if you'd like to donate, their website is srfcure.org. From ABC News, this has been Perspective. Thanks for listening. The show was produced by Leighton Schneider. If you want to listen to any of our past shows, you can subscribe to the Perspective podcast. Give us a review if you've got the time. Tell us what you'd like to hear in the future and what you think. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find Perspective and other ABC News shows at abcaudio.com/podcasts. For ABC News, I'm Sherry Preston.